Okay, well, my talk is really might have preceded Patrick's. It's related, particularly the experimental methods are related to the first of the two experiments that Patrick discussed. And I'm concerned with a somewhat more basic distinction, namely the difference in the way in which mixing occurs in two cases. One being the case of chaotic advection, and the second being the case of weak two-dimensional turbulence. And in particular, I want to get at the role of the two physical processes that govern mixing, namely stretching and folding of fluid elements on the one hand at large scales, and diffusion on small scales. But the way in which these two processes are balanced is quite different in the cases of chaotic and turbulent mixing. This work was done really mainly by David Rothstein, a student at Haverford, Emmerich Henry, a student from École Normale Supérieure de Lyon, and Wolfgang Grosser, a postdoc in my lab. Thank you very much, Srini. And a preliminary version has appeared, but a long paper is in the works. Well, I think you all know what chaotic advection is, but just to review, we're talking about flows in which you get a complex scalar field without a complex velocity field. And the rationale for this was stated first in a paper of Aref in 1984, a very beautiful paper to read even now, where he made this point clearly and in a logical, convincing way. There have been many experiments on chaotic mixing. Julio Aquino especially made large contributions to this subject. Maybe I'll just put up Aref's original numerical simulation, which made the point that time periodic velocity fields even could produce very strong mixing of fluid elements, leading to an almost complete homogenization after a modest number of cycles of this time periodic field. The experiment that I'm going to describe is similar to Patrick's. In fact, we learned how to use this system through a visit from one of his graduate students to our lab at Haverford. And as in Patrick's experiment, there is an array of magnets and two layers of fluid, one being a saline solution, which is driven. It's a lower layer here, which is driven by an electric current, and then a passive upper layer, which floats upon it and remains separated from it simply by buoyancy. One feature is different from what Patrick described, and that is that we begin with a situation where half of the upper layer contains a fluorescent dye, and we look at its homogenization over time as it spreads across the system. The characteristic dimensions here are of the order of 15 centimeters or so, and the upper layer in which mixing is occurring is about 1 millimeter thick, and it is nearly two-dimensional. Maybe it would be best to look at the situation from the side. We have this saline solution, which is driven by the magnetic field. Below, it's just somewhat thicker, and then floating upon it is the dye solution of interest. The velocity profile from the bottom looks something like this. So in the lower part of the layer, we have certainly a gradient of the horizontal velocity. But in the upper part, the gradients are much smaller. the horizontal gradients of the velocity are much smaller. It is nearly uniform, although the degree of uniformity will certainly depend on the accelerations of the fluid elements that are being experienced, since in the presence of sufficient acceleration, there can be some lag. Is there a problem? Is it not on? Oh. Thank you. Is that better? I'm talking to the people on the web, not to you. So, one of the nice things about this method is that you can use quite a variety of forcing approaches. One of the things we were interested in was the question of whether spatial periodicity or non-periodicity in the forcing mattered, had a significant effect on the dynamics of the mixing. There is not, in fact, a very large dependence, but we thought there might be. This shows the magnets, black and white, being north and south poles facing upwards. One trick that we discovered that turned out to be important was putting the fluid cell in the feedback loop of an operational amplifier, because there are boundary layers that develop at the electrodes that can quite significantly affect the current. So if you really want to control the mixing and make it really periodic or non-periodic under the experimenter's control, it really is important to avoid the effects of these boundary layers. Typical velocities from particle image velocimetry look something like this. They're basically vortex patterns. This is just a part of the cell. But they're typically localized vortex patterns that can be either regular or irregular, depending on the nature of the forcing which has been imposed. Yeah, part of the picture. Right, the cell, it's actually bigger than that. Right. Twice in each direction, approximately. Yeah, I mean, mostly we're tracking a die, and we do occasional PIV measurements, but they're, in this picture, they're on the interface between the two fluids. In this. We have done some checking of this, and you want to know if it's accurately 2D or if it's an incompressible 2D flow, and we know that it's that deviations from incompressibility are less than 10%, but we don't know if they're we have some checks of this. I don't have it with me. It was done some time ago. It is a question. Basically, what happens is that the flow responds to the since the flow is quasi steady. I mean, it changes very slowly in time. Pressure gradients build up to counteract a tendency to deviate from two-dimensionality. In other words, when you have a kind of spin up, but the layer levels adapt so as to counteract this tendency for fluid to spin out. And this is what restrains the deviation from two-dimensionality from being too significant. This shows an example of, in one particular case, of this chaotic mixing process, starting with fluorescent material on one side, on the right hand side, that's the white, and then the left is the unlabeled fluid. You build up an extra striation on each cycle. Here, this is the typical behavior of a chaotic mixing process, where you're generating a stretching and folding of fluid elements. The case of forcing with a disordered array looks like this in a little bit plotted in a little bit more colorful way to enhance the contrast. And the main feature is the development of the fine striations after a few cycles, 10 cycles or so, 5 or 10 cycles or so, it's very clear. But what struck us as being rather surprising at first, although understandable in retrospect, is that you compare the situation after, say, 15 cycles and that after 30 or even more, you see very little further evolution, very little qualitative further evolution after that. I would like to show that on a video also, because it's fairly striking. I have to take off the blank. There we go. So you're seeing here two pictures per cycle of the forcing, and you see the gradual development of this stretching and folding of fluid elements. But if you, I'll speed it up a little bit to save some time, but don't speed it up? Okay. All right, so if you look at every second cycle, well, it's speeding up by itself on the film. If you look at every second one, they're almost identical. Can you phase lock in your minds?
Yeah.
Okay, every second one's the same, but there's a lot of time dependence. If I showed you this to you in real time, I mean, you would see it's always time dependent, but but there's a recurrence, and there's very little evolution. It is in fact evolution. It is in fact evolving. It's getting gradually weaker. It's gradually going to fade out and become homogeneous, but it's a very slow process. This is just the same thing magnified. Now, I think I want to. There we go. This is just another one. Just another run. I guess the light in here is a problem, but. If you vary the frequency of the forcing, you get a somewhat different pattern because everything depends on the ratio between it depends on the distance that particles go between reversals. So these are just a number of different runs under different, under different, slightly different experimental conditions. Okay, I think that's enough of this. What's the question? Couldn't hear. You control the forcing period. It's externally controllable. And the typical fluid velocities are also controllable through the current that's selected for the magnetic drive. Well, as I said, there's a recurrence of a particular pattern. For any given set of experimental conditions, there's a recurrence of a pattern after some cycles, despite the time dependence, which is actually present. Now, this phenomenon, it turns out, was anticipated in a paper by Ray Bierhambert in 1994 in a simple mapping model where he looked at the mixing of mixing in a plane, an XY plane, using a simple nonlinear mapping with the novel feature of putting in diffusion after each mapping step in order to simulate the smearing out of small scales. And what he noticed was that the pattern approaches a statistically stationary state after a while. That is, the concentration field becomes some function of time, a complex function of time, multiplied by function of space multiplied by a slowly decaying function of time. In his model, this was his function of space. This is what he called it an eigenmode, but basically it's just a recurrent spatial pattern that you get in the periodically sampled, numerically simulated scalar field. And it seems to be this kind of thing that we are seeing in the experiment. There have been a lot of other papers on this problem of two-dimensional mixing. I just mentioned a few of them. There's been a lot of work by Ott and Antonsen, who considered the development of fractal behavior of the concentration field, and also the problem of how the spectra evolve. Alvarez et al. In 1998 looked at the development of self-similarity in chaotic mixing. There were a number of interesting papers. Cherkov and Falkovich and colleagues looked at the turbulent case quite extensively in about 1995. So that it's a subject that has been investigated. I want to look at some particular diagnostics, quantitative diagnostics of what we see. This shows that this is the probability distribution of the intensity of the scalar field of the images, which is linear in the concentration. And the striking feature here is that it's very complex. It's very poorly mixed. It's nowhere near Gaussian, even after 60 periods, and the same is true after 150 periods. It mixes rather poorly in the chaotic case, although the turbulent case, for the entire image, yeah. Although for the turbulent case, you'll see it mixes much better, as you would expect. But one of the themes here is that the chaotic mixing is surprisingly ineffective. If one looks at the motion of material from one side of the cell to the other, in the limit of long times, it's uniformly mixed, and the centroid of the die is in the center. Here we look at the deviations from that condition as a function of time. This is the deviation of the centroid position from the center, which goes down on a log scale, just goes down exponentially with time. So we have a very rapid motion at the beginning. This is what you see qualitatively with your eye. The fluid is penetrating quite quickly at the beginning, but the rate of penetration slows down very dramatically as time goes on. This idea that the concentration field factorizes into a product of a function of space and a function of time is something we can test quantitatively, and that's what's done in this figure, where we look at it in two ways. We fit all the images over somewhere between 40 and 80 periods into the motion. We fit them to find out the best fitting function of space. We just do a least squares fit to this form, and we find that the correlation coefficient between the functions that we derive, which I'll show you in a moment, and the data is quite high in the region where we've done the fitting, but of course deviates near the beginning where the structure is just developing early in the run. But it's very high in the region, in this region here. It's a good model. Or another way to say it is that if we compare the actual data to the fitted model, the deviations are typically in intensity units of the order of 50 intensity units, which is about 5%, 3 to 5% of the total intensity field. So basically, it's a good model for what is being seen in the experiment. This is the an example of this persistent pattern. The what you get out of the fit, it looks pretty much like any one of the images, except it's just a little bit blurred compared to the actual images. Here's the actual image at 15 seconds, and the one on the right is this this fit. But anyway, this is the function that is persistent pattern that comes out of the fitting process. Spectrum for the, yes, I am. In fact, that's next. So this is the development of the spectrum. This is wave number here it's k over 2 pi. So we have scale here. So this corresponds to a millimeter. And what one has in the spectrum is the early development of high wave number structure. So if you look, compare after 5 cycles, you have much more high wave number structure than you do initially. And then later on, if we compare late times, we have something like this. These are now 20 cycles and 100 cycles, but they've been shifted vertically a little bit to they would be too close to each other. So the difference between them has been exaggerated. They are in fact decaying, but they're decaying not as fast as the impression in the picture. These look rather close to power laws, but they're not really power laws, and they aren't always power laws, depending on the, it does depend on the parameters of the experiment, nor are power laws really expected in a transient decay experiment of this type. They tend to be steeper than bachelor scaling would provide. But as I say, there's no convincing reason to expect bachelor scaling here. The one way to characterize the development of those spectra is through the through any of the moments, but if we might just focus for a moment on the second moment. There is a growth in the second moment and in all the moments as a function of time, but then they tend to saturate after a while. This isn't a very convincing example of saturation, but they do tend to level off. The spectra, this is just a measure of the development of high wave number structure. We looked also at the development of the gradients of the scalar field, and this is a rather, I think, a nice result. If you plot the horizontal gradients in such a way as to compensate for the gradual weakening of the overall contrast in the pattern by using units of one standard deviation of the overall concentration field per unit distance, say per centimeter, to compensate for the weakening of the overall contrast, then what happens is that as after a while, if we compare, let's say, the blue and green here, 100 and 200 cycles, there is a development of a characteristic form that is roughly invariant and stops evolving. So they say the gradients are weakening, but the overall statistics are remaining constant. that's maybe a little clearer in this picture where we show the scalar gradients at a single time and fit it to a skewed stretched exponential. So it isn't symmetric as something that perhaps isn't surprising in view of the presence of an overall gradient. It tends to be basically exponential or stretched exponential. So now I need to do two more things. One is to talk about what determines the effectiveness of the mixing, and the second is to contrast this with the turbulent case. How are we doing time-wise? That's fine. So the first issue is what determines the effectiveness of the mixing, that is, the rate at which the homogenization takes place. And what we find is basically it's the path length of the fluid elements before they reverse. And we've been able to, we can see this qualitatively just by comparing several different runs with different forcing electric currents and different periods of the forcing. Let me say simply that if we compare two runs like this pair here, where the red squares and the blue circles, in this case, if we can look at the red, we have we've doubled the current, so that tends to push the fluid twice as fast, but we've allowed less time. By doubling the frequency, the net effect of that is to have the same path length before reversal, and the second moment of the spectrum grows at about the same rate in those two cases. And that's generally what we find of the spectrum of just the spectrum. So maybe the best way to illustrate this is we know what it is that determines the path length of fluid elements before reversal from the various parameters in the experiment, the magnetic field, the current, the viscosity of the fluid, and so on. One can figure out approximately what it is that's determining these path lengths. And if we look at the homogenization rates of the scalar field as a function of that parameter, which, as I said, is basically the path length, we find a monotonic dependence, roughly linear over a reasonable range, using a wide variety of forcing conditions. So maybe one way to say this is that the lack of reversibility of this flow is determined by how far fluid elements go before they're required to reverse. The same type of thing that I've talked about can be done by using stochastic forcing rather than periodic forcing. That was for time periodic forcing. If you use stochastic forcing, of course you don't have exact reproduction of the patterns, but if you look at the statistical properties, they're quite similar. There's no fundamental difference in all of the statistical measures when you force stochastically by using a random time function to drive the flow. Yes, Boris. Well, there were random phases in there. He put random phases in there. It was a deterministic mapping, but with random phases. Now, this is something that I don't really understand. I think he was trying to break up KM surfaces. That's my understanding qualitatively of what he was trying to do. Yes, Carl.
I don't see why you don't expect the mind to
Well, right. Uh, This is something we could discuss. I basically, my view is that that it's not a steady state experiment, and so it's not clear what you should expect. No, it's running down. It's gradually homogenizing. Now, whether that's sufficient to... Yes, but the scalar field is running down. You don't think that's enough? No? Anyway, anyway, we don't reliably see convincing Batchelor power law in this experiment. That's a fact. So the reasons for it are subject to discussion. But let me go on to the... I want to go to the turbulent case because I think that's interesting. In the same apparatus, we can look at the turbulent case simply by reducing the viscosity. The initial experiments were done with glycerol water solutions, and you can simply go to you leave out the glycerol and get modest low Reynolds number turbulence. This is an example of the mixing under that condition. Sorry. That's about half. That's about half of the size of the tank. That's right. The spectrum of this turbulence is of the velocity field now is a fairly well-defined cutoff at a wave number corresponding to a certain vortex size. So it's not a well-developed cascade or anything, but it's but it has a well-developed it has a fairly well-defined cutoff wave number. There is a quite a dramatic contrast in the mixing in these two cases. If we compare the chaotic and the turbulent cases, the turbulent mixing is really dramatically faster and is essentially complete in 20 or 30 cycles, whereas the chaotic case requires hundreds of cycles to mix. And to us, this was surprising. We hadn't we'd always thought of I'd always thought of chaotic mixing as being reasonably effective. And in this direct comparison, it's really dramatically less effective. That point is made here in a plot that still could use some more data. But if we compare the decay rate of the contrast, the overall contrast, say the variance in the scalar field as a function of Reynolds number, the chaotic cases were down here, taking hundreds of cycles to decay to by a factor of E, and the turbulent cases are a factor of 20 or so higher. So there's really quite a dramatic difference in the two cases. All the other statistics are also significantly different. For example, if we look at the spectra, spectra of the scalar field, again, here now in the turbulent case, this is now as a function of time from earlier times to later times. They don't simply go parallel to each other, retaining their shape and gradually weakening with an overall decay. It's very different. Rather, you do lose power preferentially at the higher wave numbers compared to the lower wave numbers. In other words, qualitative way to say this is that in the turbulent case, the striations really do become blurred by diffusion, whereas in the chaotic case, it doesn't happen. In the chaotic case, you generate high wave number structure as fast as you remove it, and the sharpness of the striations is not affected. Diffusion does not blur things out in chaotic mixing, but in turbulent mixing, in this transient experiment, it really does. Uh, the cutoff is at 1. The cutoff is around here. So we're not forcing these wave numbers directly. That was your question. Yeah. Carl. Uh-huh. Yeah. There really is stretching and folding going on in the CATA case here, which is not going on in the case of fossil turbulence, right? So why? I'm not quite sure why. Okay. I look forward to being enlightened. Yes. Yes. Here I would. Yeah. Yes. What I want to. Yes. I don't actually agree with this, and let me explain why. In the turbulent case, we have a balance, a kind of non-equilibrium steady state, which is a balance between stretching and folding of fluid elements and diffusion on small scales. Diffusion is, in fact, occurring on small scales, and is precisely sufficient to balance the production of high wave numbers by stretching and folding. So diffusion is not irrelevant. But now you might ask more quantitatively, suppose we double the diffusion coefficient, what would be different? Would it really depend on what the molecular diffusivity is? And the answer to that question is that there would be a cutoff scale that would vary, that would change a little bit. But the overall process would not become faster. If we look at our mixing rates, would not become faster.
I think that one other thing you're referring to is where they're materialized, the letter says, in the same line.
A topological difference. Yeah. In both cases, diffusivity is good. Yeah. Boris? Yeah, go ahead. We don't know the answer to that. We don't know the answer. It might be worth, perhaps it would be, do you think it would be worth looking at?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Carl.
One last question.
Yeah.
I think it's described by Project Baker, Carl.
Yeah. Let me finish up since we're at the end. The last data is just on the gradient of the PDF of the gradient of the scalar field in the turbulent case. And what I want to say is that it passes through a state that's very similar statistically to what we get in the chaotic case, but it doesn't stay there. If we look at 10 cycles, the distribution has basically exponential tails. It's quite similar to what we get at a certain point in the chaotic case, But in the turbulent case, it doesn't remain there. It continues to evolve into a Gaussian, the blue curves, which does not happen in the chaotic case. So one can think of the initial processes as being somewhat similar, but there's certainly a big difference in the ultimate statistics. So that's what there is. This is a summary. Perhaps I don't really need to go through it. The main point is that the chaotic and turbulent cases really do look quite different in the same apparatus, both in the mixing rates, in the spectra, and in the distributions of the gradients. So I think I'll stop. Thank you. Lyapunov exponents of the velocity for the velocity fields. We're setting up to do that right now. We have focused more on the scalar than on the velocity field, and we realized it would be useful to. Well, the velocities and the scales are about the same, but the those are just gross measures. Eric? Yeah, I mean, we don't see them. Well, it's a little unclear whether we see great inhomogeneities very large inhomogeneities in the field. There are regions which have high concentration, regions which have low concentration. We don't see regions which are strictly empty. But one of the things we want to do right now is to look at a situation where we break the symmetry by looking at forcing in two orthogonal directions in order to be sure that there are no. Yeah. Right. I mean, it does depend somewhat on where you put the interface. If you move the interface over half a centimeter, the details of the process are different, but the statistics look rather similar. So. That does seem to be true. Boris? Well, I said stochastically driven. The stochastically forced case, that is just force with a wide, with broadband in time. It looks almost the same. I mean, statistically, it looks similar to the chaotic case, not to the turbulent case. You cannot simulate turbulence with a homogeneous time function that is random. Yeah. Right. Not. No. Well, if you look at the development of the spectrum, the saturation of the second moment, the development of the PDF of the gradients, they were rather similar. Yes. The turbulent case is fundamentally different because the velocity field is not linked to the forcing. I mean, the fluid does whatever it wants. It's uncorrelated in time at each location. It's just fundamentally uncorrelated. Certainly the statistics of the velocity field would be very different in the two cases, and we see quite a difference in the mixing as well.
unquote.
The question about three-dimensionality has always been a concern of mine in this experiment. It's not perfectly two-dimensional, although the buoyancy keeps the layers separate for the duration of the experiment. But still, there are small vertical gradients in the velocity field. The question is whether they're significant or not. And you're asking whether they're more significant in the turbulent case than in the other case. Yeah. Well, the Reynolds number is too low to actually have, some secondary vortex structure in a one millimeter layer. My opinion is that there's not a dramatic difference. After all, this change from we can change the Reynolds number by a factor less than a factor of 2 and get a factor of 20 change in mixing efficiency. So it's not as if we're changing the Reynolds number dramatically. What changes is whether the velocity field is being linked to the driving current. Okay, thank you.